to episode 214 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and today I'm joined by Mariah Fredericks to talk about Death of a Showman, the fourth installment of her series featuring ladies' maid Jane Prescott. It's always great to talk to Mariah, and we have to mention that she was recently nominated for an Edgar Award. Someone else got it, but it is an honor to be nominated. So I want to thank you for joining the podcast again, Edgar nominee.
Oh, thank you so much, Nancy. This is one of my favorite times of the whole launch process is talking with you.
That is really nice of you to say, and you said very kind things about the podcast on Twitter, which is really appreciated. So thank you for that as well. The story of Death of a Showman opens, as all of your series has done, with advanced years, Jane Prescott. Mm-hmm. In this book, she's attending the musical Cats. And the story in Death of a Showman deals with Broadway on the cusp of World War I. And it occurred to me that Broadway was both a very different place and very much the same in between 1914. And I would guess Cats opened in the late 80s?
Early 80s. It was 1980 or 81. I can't remember, but yeah.
So I know you spoke in your acknowledgments about the research. So I thought that might be an interesting place to start the podcast, because you did a tremendous amount of research on theaters.
Well, I'm lucky that I live in New York and I grew up 2 miles from Broadway at a time when you could get orchestra seats for $13, if you can believe it. And standing room was really cheap. So as a kid, I saw an enormous amount of theater. Like I saw Sweeney Todd 4 times, which seems unthinkable now. And I was always at the Lincoln Center has a library that's dedicated exclusively to the performing arts, whether it's music, theater, or film. And I spent a lot of time there. So all of this was basically a fabulous excuse to just go back and revisit all my adolescent obsessions. And, you know, when I was growing up, it was like Rodgers and Hammerstein was sort of the gold standard, you know, with Sound of Music. And then you had, you know, West Side Story and, you know, the later Sondheim works. But I didn't know that much about Broadway, which was sort of just starting to be called Broadway. I had to Google whether or not, like, it was referred to as Broadway at the time, even though the Theater District had moved to the Times Square area. So finding out about what a musical entertainment looked like at this time was really, really fascinating. It's an amazing time with, you know, the Barrymores and Vernon and Irene Castle and Fanny Bryce, and you got Ziegfeld doing his thing, and an enormous amount of exciting talent and real change going on.
Exactly. There was a segue from the sort of vaudeville series of acts, and you touch on that slightly in your book, the introduction of shtick, to the idea of more legitimate theater as an entertainment. Not to say that there hadn't always been Shakespeare had been produced New York. So it is an interesting time. My personal preference is I can't help but think that some of it is influenced by the emerging medium of motion pictures.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, one of the characters goes off to make their fortune in movies at the end. So.
Not, you know, which is a little like what Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks did. They both started on the stage and were in New York before they left to become the power couple of Hollywood. So
right.
Anyway, back to Death of a Showman. You know, and we'll talk about which showman and how he died. So many of the characters in Jane's circles of acquaintance, of employment, and her friends are back. Louise Tyler, for whom Jane works as a lady's maid. Louise's husband, William, although he's not as prominent in this book. Newspaper Michael Behan is back, still balancing his obvious affection for Jane and her proximity to news that will help him get inches in the paper and maybe even a byline. And Leo Hirschfeld, with whom Jane shared a few dances and kisses, is front and center, and which is a place I realize he relishes. So
yeah, he does.
Talk a little about the story and maybe a few words about the showman who has gone unmentioned, his name has. And what the heck is Louise up to?
Well, good question. Originally, for, you know, the series progresses year by year, and this year is 1914. And originally, I had planned to have the Tylers and Jane in Vienna for this book, attending Louise's sister's glittering wedding to a Hungarian count. But more and more, I thought it actually made sense for our young Americans to be in New York at the time and to have the brewing World War, sort of something that's happening over there. And that we would be sort of heedless and happy and caught up in sort of more lighthearted things. And that brought me immediately to Leo and dancing and romance and Broadway success and very determined ambition. So it was, I got to go back to Leo a little. He was always going to come back, but he came back a little faster than I had planned, because as you say, he does like to be front and center. So Louise gets caught, Leo appears at the Tyler house just as they have come back from Europe, and charms Louise into coming into a rehearsal. And Louise immediately gets the theater bug, as so many of us did. But Leo has an ulterior motive. The man who gave him his first Broadway show, the producer Sidney Warburton, who owns the theater, is a complete monster and very controlling. And Leo is looking for sort of a counterweight to his power. So as always with Leo, he has a little bit of an agenda. It works out wonderfully for Louise, I think.
Not so wonderfully for the producer, however.
No, Sidney Warburton, I haven't written a character this dislikable since Nori Newsom, who was the cad who dies in the first book, No Importance. And, you know, it's an old joke, everybody wants to kill the producer. But I thought, you know, we're also living through a time when people are really looking at men in power in the entertainment industry and how abusive they've been and how much they exploit their ability to give work that so many people desperately, desperately want. So I thought it was a good time to make that character a murder victim.
Well, I guess as you said, sometimes people just deserve their fate. Fictional, I should add.
Fictional fate.
Fictional. So in my head, I often, you know, I'm a former magazine person. So in my head, I often give books decks or subtitles. And for Death of a Showman, it was Jane Gets Cranky. Because while she was patient to a fault, at least to the outside world in the first three books, this time around, she seems a bit chippy. She's just come back from the extended trip to Europe that you mentioned. Her patience is tried with her employers. And, you know, is this, I was wondering, though, a little bit, is this a case of how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they read, which I know hadn't quite been written at the time, or just part of Jane's evolution, because she's very cranky with Leo, who has broken her heart.
Yes, but she's not admitting that, which is...
No, Jane.
Not admitting that. You know, by book four, I felt like Jane had built up enough goodwill that I could start growing the character a little bit. And I think we really only grow when we make mistakes, and when we take some risks. And so I wanted her to get emotionally caught up and to occasionally do some things that she herself would not necessarily be proud of, and to wrestle with feelings that she hasn't really allowed herself to wrestle with. She doesn't like being dependent on people. And it's not just Leo. I mean, her dynamic with Louise is shifting as well, as Louise steps out in the world and finds her own sort of sense of self. She's not as dependent on Jane anymore, emotionally or in other ways. And I think that that is a little unnerving to Jane. And she is, I mean, one thing that I remembered writing this book is at one point she and Emma have her friend who is an anarchist and who is a believer in violence as a way to advance, you know, the human condition. It's regrettable, but it has to happen. At one point they're having an argument about murder, and some of that chippiness that you're referring to, or bad temper, does kind of surface. And I remembered in the last book, American Beauty, Jane herself was physically attacked. And I think that gives her a different investment when it comes to talking about the impact of violence on people. So, you know, I think she's growing, and I think growth is painful in some ways.
And I, you know, I don't think you harp on themes, but you did mention that she was attacked in Death of American Beauty, and Death of an American Beauty was very much about, you know, how men have exploited women. I mean, this is absolutely nothing new in 1913, 1914, or 2021. The only difference is there's a little bit more press about it, a little bit more talking about it. But I, although that wasn't as prominent in this book, it was very much there. Mm-hmm. The producer is a pig. I'm sorry. I love your books. I love your characters. But the producer, you do a good pig, I gotta say.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I don't think it was in any way exaggerated, his sanctimoniousness about his family, his ways of seduction and holding out the promises of employment to women, his contempt for the one woman that he marries off to someone else, to Leo, as a sort of as a prize, or you know, to get her out of the way. It's a contemptible and familiar thing. And so, you know, and also you talked about Anna, who is not as prominent, although I found the argument that she has with Jane really telling, because, and I should shut up and let you talk, but it was a very, very violent, it was a very violent time, the middle part of that decade. Bombs were the weapon of choice for anarchists. They blew up Wall Street. They blew up parades in Chicago and in San Francisco. They bombed a newspaper in Los Angeles in 1910. It was the thing.
Right. Right. I mean, I was remembering when I first saw Reds. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Maureen Stapleton is so wonderful as Emma Goldman. And there's that line where Jack Reed says to her, "Oh, I'll walk you home, E.G." And she says, "Why? I'm not going to hurt anybody." And you laugh. And I recently heard her compared to my congresswoman, AOC. And I thought, well, if AOC's partner had gotten into Jeff Bezos's office and taken several shots with him at him and nearly succeeded in killing him with AOC's knowledge and cooperation, then yeah, that might be somewhat similar. And I mean, which is not to say that Emma Goldman isn't an admirable person, but as you say, like, violence was much more, people felt the stakes were so high and the possibility of change was so remote that unless you committed violence, it just wasn't going to happen.
And I think even in the insulation of the United States, some of the political movements that were roiling Europe, the Communist Revolution had, the Bolshevik Revolution had not happened in Russia yet, but it was fermenting. The revolution in Ireland, which might even be a little bit closer to home for many of the residents of New York, was roiling. Was that sort of history part of what you were thinking of as you were writing this, though? To the counterpoint of Broadway and fantasy against the reality and what was building up and what was going to happen?
Yes, I mean, I think that tension, the hope is that tension is present in all of the books, but I think in Showman, the fantasy takes more of a center role. Like in American Beauty, you have the department store and all that glitz and luxury as compared to what's happening to the women on the Lower East Side. So I always want to give a sense of a world that's marching to a slaughterhouse, basically, and that it's fun and it's lovely and it's lively and very dynamic and creative, and that, you know, this bloodshed is coming right around the corner. I mean, you mentioned events in Ireland. I'm hoping to bring that in the 1916 book. I mean, that all that the violence that they think of as happening over there is coming here, and it will make itself felt.
So this is the second book that you have released in pandemic times. I know we're emerging. You were so busy in April, we couldn't have time. So I think that's very interesting, because last year when you launched Death of an American Beauty, all of your book signings at physical brick and mortars had been canceled.
Yep.
And this time around, they didn't even bother to schedule them. You were on many, I watched a few of the many panels and interviews, and you were caught up in the Edgar Awards, which were also virtual. And then I read a piece in Publishers Weekly about how the idea of book tours and the idea of you know, in real life book signings, we might be evolving away from that. And I know that you had very engaging, I never got the opportunity to go to one, but I know that you had very engaging book signings. And so as a writer who's now firmly, and we'll talk about, you mentioned your book for 1916, and we'll talk about your next book in a second, but I thought this would be a nice time to talk about, as a writer with a series, with a very devoted following, what does this mean to you as a writer who engages with her readers?
Well, in some ways, like technology is fabulous. I'm having a wonderful back and forth with a reader in Florida, who keeps asking me questions, and she keeps saying, "Oh, is it okay that I'm asking?" I was like, "I love talking to readers. This is great." It is, and I would never have probably done Foxtail Books in Georgia, and that was just a total joy. I mean, it was a wonderful way to meet readers that I probably would not have traveled to meet under the old circumstances. So in that way, Zoom has been wonderful. I think people are always going to want to meet authors or have a chance to converse with them face to face. I mean, I don't know if like people are always going to want to meet Lee Child. I mean, there are just certain, mega stars that people are excited to be in a room with. But yeah, Zoom has been, I mean, both as a viewer, there's so much I've gotten to see and engage with that I wouldn't have been able to. And as an author, it has given me a lot of opportunities.
When I read the pub, I have been contemplating ending the podcast, and I'll explain why. One of the reasons is I have watched so many of the live author events. I watched Bloody Scotland remotely. I think the idea of the writers' conferences and like Theakston's Bloody Scotland, BoucherCon, all of these wonderful, wonderful gatherings are going to be forever changed. They will be in real life again.
Yeah, I
But
think
I
so.
think there is going to be an interactive element that opens them up to the rest of the world. And I think that that is a wonderful thing. I can't go to Stirling, Scotland every year. And writers from all over the world can't participate in Stirling or wherever BoucherCon is located that particular year, or Left Coast Climb, or any number of these festivals all over the world. I decided not to end the podcast, though, because of that article. I thought to myself, one of the things I always wanted to replicate was the experience of of a Q&A with a writer at a book event. So maybe.
Well, I hope you keep it going. I
Well,
really.
thank you very much. The pandemic was very, very good to the podcast, as it was to many podcasts. But we'll see what happens as we go on. Anyway, I have shelved that idea for now. So we talked about the harbingers that were in your book, the reading of the headlines that were leading up to World War I, or as they called it then, the Great War. Jane had seen some of these undercurrents when she was in Europe, but just previous. So let's talk about 1915 and the fifth Jane Prescott novel, because you've mentioned 1916, so I'm assuming there's another one. And the second part of my question is influenced by my interview with Charles Finch, when we talked about his three-volume prequel for his character. So are there any thoughts on a Jane Prescott prequel? Or have you thought about a standalone and made your publisher pull his or her hair out?
Well, interestingly, the next, I'm working on two next books, but the first one that's going to come out is a standalone. And it's based on, it's a true crime novel about the Lindbergh kidnapping, told from the point of view of Betty Gao, who was his nanny and who became a prime suspect, as did her boyfriend. So that will be the next book to come out. And that's presented a whole different range of pleasures and challenges and all of that. But for Jane, I also have several chapters of that one written. And you mentioned that William is not so prominent in this book. And unfortunately, I give him sort of the role of like the Tisking husband. And I thought, oh, poor William.
He's a nice guy. He's a nice guy.
He's a very nice guy. And I thought he really deserved better from me than that. And and he didn't have a big role in Beauty. So I thought it was time to bring William back. And Louise, for various reasons I won't discuss, doesn't need Jane as much in the next book. So William strikes out on his own to open his own law firm. And he is tremendously idealistic. And he asks Jane to be his secretary. Because at the end of Showman, he and Louise decide they want to send Jane to night school. So they open their offices, and it's complete crickets. And then finally, an old friend of his who comes from a notable family that runs one of the, you know, notable newspapers of New York says, "My family is being blackmailed. Would you look into it? You're such a good fellow," and it's sort of like, you know, it will stay between us, the, you know. And it turns out that what this man is blackmailing the family about is an explosion at one of their printing presses that killed Michael Behan's father many years ago. And it looks like murder. And Jane and William get involved, finding out what happened then. The man who was blackmailing the family is murdered. What happened to him? And Jane starts digging into the Behan family history. And Michael is actually very displeased by this. But it's sort of a turning point book in the series, so I want to take my time with it, so the standalone will come out first.
Well, even though it's true crime, I hope you'll talk to us.
Of course. It's a novel. It is truly a mystery.
Novelized. Okay.
It's novelized because always the question was, the Lindbergh family, the night of the kidnapping, was in a house that was still under construction, and they were never there on a Tuesday. So the assumption has always been one of the staff in their house or her mother's house gave the tip off to the kidnapper.
Well, it's one of those stories that America has remained fascinated with, and I'm sure it will be fascinating read. And I always look forward to catching up with Jane. So maybe I'll get a chance to talk to you twice.
Oh, well, that would be wonderful.
And once again, thank you for your time. Thank you for talking to us and for joining the podcast and for writing this wonderful series, because it's a great series. It's historical but not cloying. I really enjoy it.
Thank you. Thank you.